Hi, I'm Jo Beth.
And I'm Katrina.
And this is Home Team.
In this episode, we talk about The Jail Is Everywhere, Finding the New Geography of Mass Incarceration by Jack Norton, Lydia Pillow-Hobbs, and Judah Schupt. We're going to start off with a little overview of the book, you know, kind of the main themes, stuff like that. And then we'll give a little intro to the authors before we get into some of the main content takeaways.
Yeah, so this book is sort of a series of different essays almost and interviews by a number of people across the country, you know, from everywhere from like rural Illinois to Louisiana to Atlanta and New York, talking about not just the development of jails, but sort of the development of local carceral systems and apparatuses of incarceration, and really talking about really those discussions of like why people are opposed to jail expansion and different tactics people have used to fight that in their local communities, particularly talking about how, you know, we think about mass incarceration as this like federal thing, this national thing, but that system relies so much on local sort of funding, really, to be able to prop up that federal system of our kind of like federal and then network of state laws that really criminalize people for a lot of like just survival activities. And and so it's kind of like what I felt like I was seeing throughout it was sort of like how it looks so different but also similar in so many communities across the country that have what we would expect to be very different sort of like political like backgrounds or sort of expectations of like that kind of red versus blue binary, but that so many local communities are, regardless of what your sort of perceived idea of their politics, that they're all, at least the people in sort of elected and sort of people who have the access to the purse strings, are very willing to sort of lean into incarceration as both a tool of economic development, but also of just sort of like, this is what we have to do to address these like social ills that that we don't, we act like we don't know what else can be done to address those.
Yeah, I think that one of the interventions that this book is making is attention to like hyper-local scales, because what you're saying about talking about federal incarceration is, I don't want to say the majority of stuff that's been written about incarceration, but I think that it is, it's been a primary focus and people...
Yeah, like gets the most attention,
yeah,
it feels like.
People have neglected how important jails are, and especially in the last, you know, I don't know how many years because I'm terrible at estimating things, but there has been like a large boom in both jail growth and the number of people incarcerated in jails. This is also a book about fighting against jails, both the development of jails and making jails bigger. And I think that this is a book for organizers, particularly to figure out how we can build solidarity between all these different fights. Like Jova said, this book is an edited volume. So Jack Norton, Lydia Pillow-Hobbs, and Judah Schupt are the editors of this book, and they brought together a bunch of people doing different jail fights across the country. Jack Norton is a professor at Governor State University in Chicagoland in criminology, and he graduated from CUNY, where he worked with Ruth Wilson Gilmore, at least in part. Lydia Pillow-Hobbs is a professor of geography at University of Kentucky. She is, full disclosure, my advisor. She also did her grad work at CUNY, and she has a book about New Orleans and Louisiana jail stuff, which is really useful if you're interested in a more in-depth view of how jails work in the U.S., called Prison Capital. Judah Schacht is a professor in criminology at Eastern Kentucky University, and he has written two other books, including most recently Cold Cage's Crisis, and then Progressive Punishment, which we are reading next on the Carceral Track. Before we jump right in, let's talk about what abolition means, because that's sometimes a word that people don't have a lot of context for, or maybe they have a context in relation to slavery, and that's not what we're talking about specifically to prison abolition in this moment.
Yeah, so to me and to what I like stuff that I've sort of read and absorbed, abolition, when we sort of use the shorthand of abolition, what we're talking about is abolition of the prison industrial complex. And that means everything from prisons, jails, policing, surveillance, this sort of range of state infrastructure that that criminalizes and cages people. I think there's like so much more probably to like explore in that, but the sort of idea that, like maybe with slavery, some people said, we can't ever live without that. That's just an inherent part of our system and our culture and our economy. Like, we couldn't ever get rid of that. I think for some people that sounds like saying, I don't think that prisons should exist. People kind of like go, whoa, whoa, what? From what I've read and sort of if I like pick myself up and like put myself back in like the 1800s, it sounds very similar, like conversations in the history I've read about people saying like, well, abolition of slavery could never happen because XYZ reasons. And so with today in our modern context, using that word abolition as saying that this sort of range of infrastructure and practices in our culture and our society actually really isn't necessary. And that there's other things that we could be doing to address the behaviors that we're currently using prison and policing for.
I think that abolition is about like building up life-giving institutions too. It's not just like a tearing down process, and it's not like we will close all the prisons day one. It is essentially arguing that we need structures, whether state or otherwise, that take care of people as like their main mode of operation instead of punishing people and locking them up. A thing that I think that Ruth Wilson Gilmore says in Golden Gulag, which we read later, is that we have, as a society, said that the prison can solve all of our problems. And that's clearly not true. Prisons create a lot more harm and a lot more trauma, and they're not actually fixing much, if anything. So it's this assertion that like we can build a better world and a different world that doesn't involve putting humans in cages. Those are some of our like initial thoughts. And something that we are trying to do with this reading group is to encourage you all, people listening along, people reading with us, to come up with their own framework for abolition and understand what it means to you. You might disagree with us on some of these things. So that's okay. If this book teaches us anything, it's that we can build solidarities across people who disagree.
So now with that shared framework and kind of working definition, let's jump into some of the main points and kind of takeaways from the book.
One of the things that I wrote down when I read this first book was that it's like really refreshing that this is a book where we don't have to like rehash abolition as an argument. It's just kind of like taking it as a thing that we're all working towards, which isn't necessarily true for everyone coming to this book, but as like an ideological framework, it's refreshing that we can just like say that that's the goal. I think my biggest takeaway is that this book is really clear about the need to be against expanding carceral infrastructure in any form, in any capacity. There's a thing that the Ruth Wilson Gilmore and Craig Gilmore talk about as like reformist reforms and non-reformist reforms. So the point is like, we don't want to reform the system so that it has more power and more scale and more capacity. We want to reform it so that its scope and power and financial scale is smaller. So yeah, that's one of my takeaways. What about you?
Yeah, the first thing I wrote down, and I can't remember if it was from, it must have been from Ruth Wilson Gilmore's forward introduction, that that it really talked, the quote, abolition requires that we change just one thing, everything. And I think that is like, so it really is a thread throughout like a lot of the essays and interviews of just sort of like how much people are talking about all of these like human needs that people are experiencing. And that's the thing that they see the need to invest in their community. And that, yeah, that idea of like abolition, not just being like a something that you're sort of breaking something down, but that here's all of these things that we need to be building. And that, you know, I think something that I found very refreshing was sort of that conversation a lot of the organizers were having about how complicated that is in their own community to navigate, because like you said, not everyone coming to read this book or coming into these spaces is fully on the same page, but that's, there's something like generative about that if you're at least like committed to sort of this, maybe this one fight and like this one plate, like so this one scope, and that you can start to like have that relationship and connection to say, okay, well, what is it that we do want to see? And sort of that ability to like build towards a vision versus just being like, again, something, whether someone wants to call it abolition or not, is something that like can be like a driving force for like organizing in a community.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes, this is from page 40. I don't remember who was talking. But the quote is, but we had to be able to mount a political argument against that wasn't just fuck you, we're not building a jail. I think that it's really important to remember that jails are like in this larger political economic context. And sometimes that means we have to use the language of economic things to talk about why it doesn't work. I think we should also talk about carceral humanism in this context.
It was very prominent in a lot of the essays and conversations that a lot, some of the, like the sort of pushback from the people wanting to create a jail or expand a jail was like, oh, well, this is where we're going to give mental health care. You know, it's kind of trying to respond, I think, to community frustration or, you know, saying, well, this is what we actually need. And sort of the people saying, well, but we still need to be able to like force people into these like modes of care, that we will build it into the jail. We'll make the jail a little nicer. We'll make sure that it has healthcare, it has mental health care. And sort of this like weird middle place of like trying to still get what they perceive they want or need, which is like expanding the jail, but just trying to sort of say, but we're going to make it nicer.
Yeah, this idea comes specifically from a Rose Braz article in 2006, and then James Kilgore's more clear notation of this as carceral humanism in 2014. And it is essentially the idea that you can make kinder, gentler cages, which we have seen a lot in Oklahoma City, which we won't get into more here because we could talk about that forever. But it is, yeah, broadly the idea that locking people up can be good for them. And it's a reform project, and we should just like paint the jail a green because it'll be better for people's mental health as they're locked in a cage. Very surface level reforms.
Again, sort of talking about like looking back at history and seeing like, oh yeah, in the 1800s and like, you know, Britain, that's like, or even in the US, like all of this like reform conversations where like, you know, these wealthy ladies being like, oh, we need to make this place a friendlier, nicer place because we see this human suffering and you're just putting people in jail. It's like this literally the same conversation that people are having like 200 years ago, which is like, I think a really fascinating thing to sort of see continually replicated in like this book, in the conversations in these books, or in this book, because of like, oh yeah, we're not really having a different conversation than we were. We're kind of back at square one. And so maybe that's part of why abolition is so key to this conversation is that we can't really build ourselves or make, yeah, we can't build ourselves a friendlier jail, that at the end of the day, it's a jail and it's going to replicate a lot of the harms that just existed, no matter how much you try to reform it through like the expansion or sort of like tweaking things kind of at the edges.
Yeah, I think really crucial to our organizing fights is a knowledge of history, because people have tried everything to reform prisons and jails. We're not having new conversations. Stuff that we were talking about in the 1970s are still the conversations we're having today, going back all the way to like the 16th century when they were developing enclosures and prisons, which we'll talk more about in The London Hanged. It's the same stuff. So yeah, that's why we have come to abolition as the answer.
Can I transition us? So there was something, I think it was in like one of the, it was either in the intro or in like one of the first essays, talking about this thing called the anti-state state. And I feel like I know what that means, but they didn't really like explicitly define it. And I was really curious to hear your thoughts on that, especially because it feels like a very academic phrase like that's being coined there that I've never heard before. And I was just kind of curious to, it was one of those things I was like, ooh, I need to make a note of this because I want to talk about it at the reading group, but also figured maybe for people who either haven't read the book or read it and were like, what does that mean? Maybe we can talk a little bit about that.
Okay, yes. The anti-state state idea comes from an article written in 2022. It might be a book chapter, actually, by Ruth Russen Gilmore and Craig Gilmore. It's called Restating the Obvious. The anti-state state is a kind of like neoliberal, libertarian-ish state formation. So it's this specific thing that we see developing. It's more prominent more recently, but it is essentially a state that tries to destroy programs that take care of people. So it works by delegitimizing things that take care of people and then dismantling them, which we can see very prominently in this current political moment. However, one of the things that the Gilmores note, I'm just going to read this quote because it's really good. This is from page 152 of the article, and this article will be in the further reading section, if you're interested. Although no doubt there were and are some true believers in this libertarian light rant, most of those who spout it, and all of those in power, have no intention of shrinking the state. Rather, their intent has been, and continues to be, to remake the state to do other things. I've called this ideological construct, anti-state state, a state that grows on the promise of shrinking. So they're saying that they're going to pull the state out of all of these things, but in reality, they're just asking the state to do different things that doesn't look like taking care of people and is a state that I don't want.
Yeah, I feel like that's like a lot of helpful context, because that's like, it's such a good little turn of phrase that it communicates a lot, but I was like, let me make sure I'm getting this correct. And it feels so, unfortunately, like my whole lifetime, that is what I have known as like the political context, is like some of my earliest memories, you know, of like anything sort of like political were like headlines about, you know, SNAP in like the 90s, or, you know, like these like TANF things of like welfare reform and stuff that were like, we're going to crack down on welfare fraud. And sort of this, like, we're going to target some of the most modest quote unquote fraud, if it even exists, of people who are like just literally trying to survive with very little resources or access to like economic mobility. And like the fact that like it has morphed so much and become so much more of like a legitimized conversation by sort of the like both sides of the aisle, quote unquote, like is, yeah, it's just so entrenched that it, like, now we have like a, like, it's worth coining a phrase, you know, like for it, because it is such a phenomenon that, and again, like, is so, it's become such a like way of practice that it's just accepted as like these, you know, humanist, you know, like social service programs that are supposed to like help take care of people. We've completely just like continued to dismantle them. And like in our context here in Oklahoma City, it does feel in so many ways like that's like the fight so often is to change that narrative that like these are actually good and useful and like worth the investment, you know, if you want to talk in like economic terms, like worth the investment because you're going to get your money back in these other ways or whatever.
I think that this is a really important thing to talk about in terms of organizing. And so much of this work is about just like insisting that we can have a different state that actually does take care of us and funds different things. What do we think we can learn from this book in terms of organizing?
I've sort of been taught about the history of movements in our country as these like singular moments without having a lot of context or being given a lot of the like lead up of like what dynamics, what things happened that like totally fell apart before that, or what, you know, who doesn't get all the attention, you know, and like thinking about someone like, is it Claudette Colvin, who I might be saying her name wrong or getting her name wrong totally, but the woman who, like also sat on a bus before Rosa Parks, but was like darker skinned and pregnant and a teen. And so like, wasn't maybe like the, you know, the right person or whatever, to sort of be the catalyzing person for this movement. And that's what I see a lot in this, in these conversations within the book, is that there's a lot of mess and there's a lot of complicated dynamics and complicated coalition building that takes place in these situations. And that it's not always like a win isn't always you get the thing you were like really pushing for. And it's a lot messier than I think like we want it to be. And like, I think there's like a level of like us needing sometimes to reframe what our goals are, what our wins look like, and like kind of how we, how we like, what's our next step? Like of sort of, I think like for me, I often feel like, we didn't win this one like point in this moment. And so I'm so tired and I want to like bounce because it's never gonna change or be different. But that like recognizing like, oh, this is a point along this like very long moment, and sort of timeline that, we just have to kind of like keep that context alive so that we don't get kind of like burnt out and just like, okay, well, I'm done because I'm like, we're not getting anywhere, if you will.
I think it's really important to like place ourselves in this longer lineage of struggle because it gives us context and, yeah, hope is what you're talking about, essentially. One of the things that I loved from this book was how much it really endorsed knowing your shit about what's going on. Also on page 40, they're talking about how you have to do FOIA requests and be a nerd about this stuff. I think it's really important to know that a tactic is legitimately knowing more than the people who make decisions. And if we spend the time to read the budgets and read all the documents, we are going to know more than some of the people making the decisions. And that's a really good strategy to come in and be like, I actually know what's in this document.
Yeah. And specifically like that ability to sort of introduce more questions so that the people sort of at the decision-making table, you know, if you can capture in the right moment or the right window of opportunity, like someone saying, wait, why wasn't I told that? Or like, why wasn't I given that information when it is like in the document, to your point, like it's there, but often decision makers are, either they don't have interest in really looking through it, or they don't have the time. They're not making the time to do it. And the people sort of influencing decisions are selectively presenting information that sort of boon, you know, is like a boon to their case or their direction that they want to go. And sometimes being able to like, yeah, pull out like, but what about this zoning peculiarity? or, you know, there's so many times like where it's just like, wait, what nobody told us about that, sort of moments that, getting into the weeds is like a big need that, we have with like local, especially at the local level, when you can get access to these things a lot more easily than say at like high, quote unquote, higher levels of government.
I think that's one of my favorite things about having you as my city council person is your willingness to really like go in deep into the weeds on things. I really value that about how you represent us.
Well, thank you. I don't feel like I ever have enough time to do it to the level that it actually needs it, but I'm always like, I'm happy to like, and I think that's too part of the like one of the lessons from this is like that inside outside organizing of like building those relationships with those decision makers and whether they're like all on board for the cause or not, like the ability to have those conversations or have someone sort of again, quote unquote, on the inside that can like, hey, help share this burden of like digging through this stuff. Because especially if you're not, you know, paid full time to do this work in a way, either as an organizer within like a formal structure or as an elected official, like we have to share that work and that burden. Because again, it's like the burnout is real, and the ability to just feel like you're constantly playing catch up is like a real danger that I think again, like in this book, like that the sort of drum that's I kept hearing was like you need to share the work and share the responsibility.
Yeah. One last thing before we kind of wrap up here and play a little game. I think it's important that we talk about the tension that people feel between improving the material conditions of people inside and working towards abolition. And I think this book is pretty clear that the answer can almost always be getting people out of jail, decarcerating people. It's important to like improve people's material realities and their conditions. And if we want to have solidarity with people inside, which I think is a really cool thing that Lydia's book talks about really explicitly and strategies for doing that, we can hold these two things together and say, yeah, improving conditions is important. And that cannot come through building more capacity to lock more people up, because more people ending up in jail does not improve material conditions for anyone, even if it is a nicer, kinder jail.
Yeah, and I think that's something that again, kind of going back to like that non I'm going to say it wrong, but the reformist reforms and the non-reformist reforms, like always sort of trying to have that guiding light or like that like point of like long-term vision be not building, not making the apparatus bigger, not making, you know, putting money into like, oh, well, let's, you know, we can get people out, but they need to have, you know, like, you know, tags on their body, essentially. Like, you know, thinking through and keeping that light as how do we get people out and give them the things that they need to like thrive, not like not just survive, not just be in like the crappiest apartment that we could find because it was cheap and the landlord won't look at their record, but like how do we actually build like across systems within mental health care, housing, you know, all of these sort of things that are just like just so basic for like day-to-day living and day-to-day like even if you're just staying in survival mode, like being somewhere safe, that like yeah, how do we like think about that vision versus just like how do we, you know, well, the judges aren't going to let people out, so like let's make the cage a little bit nicer. It's like we need to be doing both things and having both, and I think that was a lot of like the conversation of the book is like how do we keep those things in conversation and not let like disagreements over them totally fracture a movement or a coalition. But like there might be a point at which that happens because of sort of this like again, personalities, egos, and organizing is real. It's there. But then like legitimate disagreements about tactics and direction. But like I think that's sort of the maybe like one of my main takeaways of the book is like learning how we continue to like move together, knowing that like the desire to not have people be in these conditions is maybe like the foundation belief that we can have. And then like maybe we can be working like from different angles and different sides to sort of address the issue and address like the sort of, yeah, just like the, that the, there are people in this building that they're in deplorable conditions. But how do we like stay connected? You know, how do we stay connected so that the decision makers and the power brokers that are just like, well, we just want to build a bigger jail and we want to move it out of downtown, don't get to sort of drive the narrative and sort of create those opportunities for division among different people in the community.
Yeah. Diane DePrima said or wrote, no one way works. It will take all of us shoving from all sides to bring this thing down. And I think about that all the time. It's going to take a lot of us using a lot of different tactics, and that's okay. To wrap up this section, if we had to, difficult, I know, put our key takeaways into one sentence, what would that be for you? I can start if you want.
Please do.
The thing that I'm coming back to is connecting this to OKC and our situation. And I think it's really important to remember that they're lying about the jail building being the problem. Even if we talk about fixing material conditions, it's not the building that's the problem.
Yeah, no, I don't know if I'd have anything to add to that. That is just such a good summary. And I think it provides a very nice opening for maybe conversation in the reading group meeting about what is the real reality.
Thanks for talking about this with me, Jo Beth. We're gonna take a quick break and come back with a micro game. And we're back for a micro game. Nate is here as our game designer to run this, and I have been told that it is going to be nearly impossible. So I'm excited.
That's right. So I'm excited to introduce today's game. Today's game is called Ken Boyer is Everywhere. So as you all know, the book that we've been discussing this week is The Jail is Everywhere. And so playing off that, we have a game called Ken Boyer is Everywhere. Ken Boyer Bail Bonds, the company, is famous for, among other things, the tagline, Ken Boyer is Everywhere. And according to Ken Boyer himself, this tagline originated when a young man told him that he knew who he was because he sees his name everywhere. Sure, let's go with that. Let's pretend the tagline is not vaguely threatening their clientele with being able to snatch them anywhere. This game will test how pervasive your knowledge of Ken Boyer is, given that he is everywhere you've ever been. Question number one. Oklahoma's very own Ken Boyer isn't the only Ken Boyer in existence. Who is the other Ken Boyer? A. A 7-time All-Star and MVP third baseman for the Cardinals, Mets, White Sox, and Dodgers over 15 seasons. B. A producer who specializes in animated films and TV shows such as Alvin and the Chipmunks and the Tigger movie, The Lion King, and more. C. A Seattle fishmonger with 30-plus years of seafood industry experience, the first to hold the presidency of the Western Association of Food and Drug Officials after a change in bylaws. And D. The eponymous Ken Boyer is actually Ken Boyer Jr., making his father the other Ken Boyer Jr.
Ding, ding, ding.
Katrina.
D.
Jo Beth, do you want to feel...
The fishmonger guy.
So it's actually all of them. No! Is the thing. They're all the other Ken Boyer.
There was not an all of the above.
I'm going to go ahead and award a point begrudgingly to Katrina for having part of the correct answer identified immediately, given that I was doing a little trickery there.
Those were all so wildly specific that I was like, there feels like there's something going on here, but I didn't pick up on what that thing was, which is
indeed.
They're all correct.
In any game that I design, you should always expect a little element of trickery.
Okay.
Moving on to question number two. Ken Boyer Jr., as we've now established, is the president of the Oklahoma Bondsmen Association. If you click the industry resources link in the footer of the OBA website, what are some of the types of things you might expect to find? Closest answer wins.
Ding, ding, ding.
Katrina.
Like a bounty hunter registry? What do they call it? I don't know. I don't know if bounty hunter is the correct
term. That was actually my first thought. That was going to be my guess, was like some kind of bounty hunter resource.
Jo Beth, would you like to submit an alternate guess?
I really don't have anything else that comes to mind. I'm like, I don't know enough about what their industry resources might be besides trying to capture people.
I'm going to say that oddly, you're going to go ahead and get the point that actually makes you closer, because the answer is a page that says no results found.
No page not found.
So that's a 1 point for JoBeth, for sheer confusion.
Or just technicality of...
That's hilarious.
Question number three. In 2021, the Oklahoma City Sentinel ran a profile on Ken Boyer with the headline, "Classic cars help Ken Boyer's bail bonds have a higher profile in the city." And note, that is Ken Boyer's bail bonds. Sick. According to this profile, how many classic cars did Ken Boyer own and use for advertising at the time? Closest answer wins. Price is right. Rules apply. JoBeth.
25.
Ding, ding, ding.
Katrina.
My brain said 21.
My main takeaway here is that no one has ever watched The Price is Right. No points awarded. The answer is 9.
No.
$1, we Bob. Always the best strategy. Moving on. Like any other business, Ken Boyer Bail Bonds receives reviews on Google. Also, like any other business, you can expect a range of experiences. In the case of Ken Boyer, these include very nice people, 4 stars, and not very nice people, 1 star. How many stars does the business average? Price is Right rules once again apply. JoBeth.
2.5. Can I do halves?
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, you can do half. Katrina.
I'm going to say 3.
Katrina takes this point. The answer is 4 stars, which is more stars than I would expect a glorified bounty hunter to have.
Yeah.
I've stayed at hotels with fewer stars than that, you know? This brings us to the 30-point question. Each player will have 1 chance to fill in the blank.
Oh, God.
If they fill in the blank correctly, they receive 30 points, nullifying the rest of this game. So in my deep dive on the reviews for Ken Boyer Bail Bonds, I read every single one of them because I found them fascinating. And among the 123 reviews making up Ken Boyer's 4-star average on Google, one stood out to me as being particularly interesting. So fill in the blank from this review. And I am going to dramatize the reading. I hope that's okay. Way to steal the blank graphic. You enjoy stealing all kinds of things, huh? You only have 1 star because I was forced to. 1 star. So who does this aggravated reviewer feel the Ken Boyer graphic is borrowed from?
Ding, ding, ding.
Katrina.
Is it the little Monopoly guy?
Unbelievable. That is 30 points to Katrina. And I don't understand how. It looks nothing like the Monopoly graphic.
I see it. I mean, I think for people who aren't like looking directly at, like, I see it. I did actually think at one point that it may have been taken from Monopoly.
So I think it just must be the case that there is red, there is a geometric sans serif font, and there is a little car, which is maybe one of the pieces in Monopoly.
It's the illustration of the guy. There's a little guy.
No, so Ken Boyer's logo.
Yeah, which, that with the guy being with the wings
not the logo. Yeah. It's on his like bus bench ads. Yeah. There's like a little guy holding either a bag or bags of money. And that is the guy, I think, who is from Monopoly.
Okay, so what we are learning is that Katrina, with 32 points, has perhaps taken advantage of a poorly designed game. But either way, Katrina was in the lead. We're going to go ahead and call this one somewhere between 2 and 32 points for Katrina.
Can I share? Okay, so I thought my little bit of trivia was going to come up, and it didn't, so I'd like to share it, if that's okay.
Yes.
So I am just vain enough to have done some research into who is the youngest city councilor ever elected, because I thought it might have been me, because I was 28 when I was elected first. Mm-hmm. And it appears Ken Boyer beat me by a year. He was elected when he was 27, and so he was a city councilor and has beat my youngest, or at least, again, what is recorded. Maybe there was someone in like the 20s who was like 23, but like, yeah, and that's another tick in the like why I don't like Ken Boyer is because he beat my record.
Well, you've brought me to the bonus question for somewhere between 2 and 30 points. Who was the youngest?
No.
I'm kidding.
I was like, oh my God, you didn't say there was a bonus question.
No, that's incredible information. Also, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But
one more reason to hate him.
Well, on that note, that was the micro game. And this has been
Home Team.
Mine was bad.
One more?
Yep.
And this has been Home Team.